From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ben Stiller starred in last summer's hit film There's Something About Mary. Earlier in his career, he directed his friend Janine Garofalo in his sketch comedy show and the films Reality Bites and The Cable Guy. On today's Fresh Air, Stiller and Garofalo read from their new self-help satire and talk about their movies. Also, actor Roger Glenvere Smith performs an excerpt of his show, A Huey P. Newton Story, about the co-founder of the Black Panther Party. Smith has appeared in many of Spike Lee's films and stars as the detective in Lee's forthcoming film about the Son of Sam. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the rock trio Sleater-Kinney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Israeli voters have chosen a new prime minister. It appears as if Labor Party candidate Ehud Barak is headed for a sweeping victory in today's election. The latest count gives him 60% of the vote over incumbent Benjamin Netanyahu. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
Ehud Barak is 57, a former Army chief of staff, and Israel's most decorated general. He's portrayed himself as the heir of assassinated Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Barak has pledged to revive the peace talks Netanyahu froze. He's also spoken of renewing negotiations with Syria and pulling Israeli troops out of Lebanon within a year. His ability to do any of this will depend in part on how he's able to craft a ruling coalition. Israelis have also elected 120 Knesset members, and with 31 parties, it's more fractured than ever. Barak has promised a broad-based government. The outgoing Netanyahu announced in his concession speech that he would resign as head of the rightist Likud party. I'm Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat said he hopes the change of leadership will help revive peace talks which have stalled under Netanyahu. Britain, France, and the United States swiftly welcomed Barak's win. President Clinton said he had spoken to Barak by telephone and that he has promised to work for a just, lasting, and comprehensive peace. NATO says bad weather has forced it to cancel three-quarters of its flights over Yugoslavia. The bombing campaign began on March 24th, and allies have now flown more than 20,000 sorties since then. NATO is expressing more concern about the plight of Kosovo refugees. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Sadako Ogata, says her office is distressed by reports that Serb forces are once again keeping ethnic Albanian refugees from entering Macedonia. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Ogata said the UNHCR has steadfastly maintained that borders should be kept open. Serb forces allegedly barred a train carrying some 2,000 ethnic Albanian refugees from leaving Kosovo and entering Macedonia. Ogata told NPR that is unacceptable.
We do not want any forced return of anybody back to a country that is very much endangering people. I would be against any effort to return those people who wanted to cross the border from being able to do that.
Ogata also called an upcoming trip by a UN delegation that hopes to assess civilian humanitarian needs throughout Yugoslavia an important mission. But she has doubts about free access once the team is inside the province and said serious safety concerns about both Serb forces and NATO airstrikes could thwart a serious examination of the ground reality in Kosovo. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Philadelphia.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 60 points to end the day at 10,853. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Tribal hunters have killed a gray whale off the coast of Washington state for the first time in 70 years. They used hand-thrown harpoons and a large-caliber rifle to successfully conclude the week-long hunt aimed at reviving cultural traditions. Environmentalists have been outraged by the hunt, fearing it could encourage a revival of whaling around the world. A hospital trade group says legislation which Congress passed in 1997 to help keep Medicare solvent is hurting hospitals. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
Rural hospitals, academic teaching centers, urban public health hospitals have all been complaining about reductions in payments for people on Medicare mandated by the Balanced Budget Act of 1997. So the American Hospital Association hired an economic forecasting group to project the cost of caring for Medicare patients versus what the hospitals would get paid by the government. Their conclusion, not good for the hospitals. In 2002, hospitals may be losing 4.4% to 7.8% on Medicare patients. Worst hit, according to the analysis, will be rural hospitals, who could wind up taking a 10.4% loss. A spokesperson for the Healthcare Financing Administration, the government agency that oversees Medicare, says they've heard concerns from Medicare recipients as well as hospitals, and they're looking into the situation. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
People in West Central Iowa are recovering from tornadoes which ripped through the area last night. At least two people were killed and 16 injured as the twisters struck at least four counties. They were part of a storm which dropped golf ball-sized hail and brought 8 inches of rain. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ben Stiller and Janine Garofalo are longtime friends who worked together on Stiller's sketch comedy TV show. He directed her in the films Reality Bites and The Cable Guy. He's since starred in last summer's big hit, There's Something About Mary, as well as Your Friends and Neighbors, Permanent Midnight, and The Zero Effect. Garofalo was a regular on The Larry Sanders Show and starred in The Truth About Cats and Dogs and Clay Pigeons. Now Stiller and Garofalo have co-authored a new self-help parody called Feel This Book, an essential guide to self-empowerment, spiritual supremacy, and sexual satisfaction. The book is written in a he said, she said style, with Stiller and Garofalo alternating chapters. I asked them to read excerpts from their chapters about their relationship.
Janine was not what I expected right from the start. I guess I didn't expect her to be drunk. That might sound callous and cruel, but it would be unfair to the reader to paint this relationship in anything other than its true, ugly colors. I know this does not necessarily fit with the humorous vein of the book, but you asked for it. I was at TJ O'Pootertoots, a popular eatery in Beverly Hills, for nearly an hour before Janine ambled through the revolving door, about twice before she figured out how to emerge from it. By this time, I had downed my share of gin and tonics, but I was still sober enough to smell the whiskey on her breath. She seemed very eager to find a booth where we could be alone together, and by the pizzatizers, she was feeling, well, how should I put it? Let's just say, frisky. By dessert, we were both more than a bit tipsy. We were downright sloshed. On the way to the parking lot, Janine told me she loved me, and then belched. We made out for a long time in my car, which we somehow navigated back to her house. Once there, we made messy love and passed out with our backs to each other. After that, we were inseparable.
Janine, why don't you read your she said part of the story?
Here we go. We met for cocktails and smart talk at Ben's favorite eatery, TJ O'Pootertoots. Ben is fond of family-oriented restaurants like O'Pootertoots, where pizzatizers are on the house and the birch beer flows in bottomless frosty mugs. He also enjoys singing along with the mechanical bears and the guilty thrill of tossing his peanut shells on the floor. Incidentally, this was a habit resented by many of our friends who felt it signified a lack of respect for the linoleum tile in their homes. "Get a load of me! Ain't I something?" Ben would shout when the waitstaff presented him with a birthday cake. He pulled the birthday stunt everywhere we went. At first, I was touched by his boyish love of cake, but then I realized that it was a thinly disguised cry for help. Ben had trouble expressing his needs, and conning innocent theme restaurant employees into serving him cake was indicative of a much deeper problem. Mustachioed waiters singing happy birthday was as close as he came to meaningful interaction with other adults. If he wasn't the focus of attention, Ben just couldn't cope.
That's Janine Garofalo and Ben Stiller reading from their new book, Feel This Book. So you two really were an item briefly?
Yes, for about a minute and a half, almost a decade ago. We were an item.
We went out for a really short period of time, but it you know, never really panned out. But we had a much better creative connection.
What phases of your careers were you in when you met?
The fetal?
The early pre
I was actually successful. About 6 years into my stand-up career. I started doing stand-up in 85. I met Ben in 91. So I was about 5 years into doing stand-up.
Yeah, I was, I'd never did stand-up to this day. I've never done stand-up. But I was doing, I remember I was out in California developing a show for the Fox Network, a comedy show, which took about 2 years to finally end up being what it was. And Janine was a part of it when we finally got it on the air. But at the time, I remember I was starring in a wonderful TV movie, comedy for Fox, which I considered to be one of my big breaks. It was direct. I'm not going to say who was in it or who directed it, but it was.
I know what it was with the.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Anyway,
can we find out what it was?
Worst, probably one of the worst TV movies ever.
But you and George Carlin were very good in it.
They
were.
George Carlin's brilliant.
He is brilliant.
I remember the experience was that we were shooting late at night one night, and we did a scene, and there was silence at the end of the scene. Nobody yelled cut, and we all looked over to where the director was, and he was asleep in his chair, which was a bad sign.
When you were, particularly when you were first starting off as actors, before you had a lot of credits under your belt and a lot of experience, and before people realized how talented you both were, how much did your looks affect the way you were cast and the way you were perceived?
Well, I mean, I think, any actor who gets in front of the camera, you know, how you look totally affects how you're cast and how people perceive you. From one end of the spectrum being that, you know, like, good-looking, model-y type people can work in shows that like good-looking, model-y type people, even though they might not be great actors, to the other end of the spectrum where character-y, quote-unquote, looking people can do commercials and be the guy, you know, the regular guy thing. I mean, I think people just kind of, that's the first impression that people get of you, and it will always, to a certain extent, dictate what jobs you get. I think men are afforded much, much, much more leeway in how they can look for the roles that they can play.
Right. Men, like, especially in the sitcom world, which is very lazy about casting for the most part, they will allow men to look very character-y and be the lead, whereas the women kind of really have to fit in to more of a mold, except for maybe they'll have one wild card woman on the staff, you know, who that'll be who her character is, like on Drew Carey, like the Kathy Kinney character. They use her as the brunt of jokes for, you know, certain reasons, and they don't tend to do that with guys as much. So it's just what I call lazy casting in film and television. Independent film's a little more tolerant. Theater is much, much more tolerant, and European film market's more tolerant than we are here domestically.
Janine, you have a funny part in the new book, Feel This Book, about looks. And I'm going to ask you to read that for us.
I just want to say always that I think people don't always hear what I'm saying, like when I talk about lookism or aesthetics or stuff like that. I think they think I'm coming from a much more bitter place than I'm coming from, or they, again, see it as an angry woman lashing out, and so it kind of kills some of the message. You know what I mean?
Right. It makes it seem like spoiled grapes or something.
It seems like sour grapes, yeah, which is not what I want to come from. And when it does sound like that, I'm joking. So I just don't want people to misunderstand that. Like, obviously, coming from this book is quite tongue-in-cheek, you know?
Absolutely.
So. Okay. The Ugly Truth by Jane Ann Garofalo. Libra. From the man on the street to the cop on the beat, we can all agree that it is better to be attractive. Your mother lied. Looks are everything, and the sooner you submit and stop denying the inevitable, the happier you will be. Do not misunderstand me. I dislike attractive people, as they are usually silly and weak. But it is in your best interest to try and curry their favor. You reap the benefits if there is a gorgeous guy-girl in your immediate social set. Broken down vehicles and meager funds at a bar are easily rectified if your easy-on-the-eyes mate seeks the kindness of strangers. It is not wrong to hitch your wagon to someone else's face. Surely they won't notice your parasitic behavior, since 8 out of 10 homecoming kings-queens are utterly dull-witted. In fact, just staring into the eyes of a model or actress can cause one to sleep uncontrollably. Year after year, brick by brick, a character built on the foundation of shopping in the Sears Husky section and remote corners of the Junior Miss-Mister shops gives you the right to look back in anger and forward in condescension. It is a feeling akin to the sphincter-tightening sensation provoked by the statement, Cindy Crawford is considered a larger, voluptuous model. Journalists know not what they do.
You know, it strikes me, Jeanine, that in your own career, like some people are very kind of defiant about Hollywood looksism and everything until they get into Hollywood, and then it's like, give me the glamour. And you haven't become like a glamour person, as far as I can tell, even though you're becoming really quite successful in Hollywood.
To me, it seems like it would feel and look fraudulent if I went that route to have my reinvention, as they say, or whatever people do to slim down and get a stylist and things of that nature. It would probably read as fraudulent to anyone witnessing it as it would feel to me to do it. Plus, there's so many other actors and actresses doing it that I'll let them do it. And at least you can never say this phrase about me: boy, she really let herself go. You can never say that. Any birthday I'm going to have, you can never say, wow, remember when she was, you know. So I'm doing it that way. Although one never knows what the career trajectory would be if you did those things.
Right.
You know, you never know.
Do you ever show up at a place where all the women are expected to be wearing sultry evening gowns and you're wearing, like, jeans and a sweater, or just like pants and a sweater?
I don't ever get dressed up either. Not that I go to places like to be deliberately defiant or punk rock or anything. I'm not about that either. I'm just saying that I don't feel comfortable doing that, and I don't understand why other people feel that I'm being rude when I do something like that. But I just seems like it has a real let them eat cake quality when you get all dressed up at functions. I don't know. I can't even explain why I feel that way, but it just feels elitist almost in a certain way.
Perhaps because of the thousands and thousands of dollars that one dress can cost?
Yeah, something seems kind of wrong about that, and it troubles me a little bit. And then saying, like, what are you wearing? Versace, you know what I mean? Like broadcasting who you're wearing and...
I guess I'm more of a traditionalist. If I see black tie on an invitation, I wear black tie.
Golly, I'm old-fashioned.
My guests are Jeanine Garofalo and Ben Stiller. They've collaborated on a new self-help parody called Feel This Book. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Ben Stiller and Jeanine Garofalo. They collaborated on a new self-help parody called Feel This Book. I want to ask you each about a movie that you made in the past year. And Ben, I'll start with you in asking about something about Mary, which was a huge hit, as you know.
Yes.
How did you get the role in that? I had read you had a fight for the role. Was that true?
Oh, really? Oh, well, not physically. No, I didn't get into it.
You got into a bare knuckle boxing brawl.
I think sometimes roles come easier than other roles. I don't know if the studio off the bat was excited about me being in the movie, and then they saw some of the, you know, footage, and then they were like okay with it. Honestly, there wasn't a big me campaigning for the role or anything like that.
I'm one of the many people who thought that something about Mary was very funny, and I have a feeling if I had just seen the script, I wouldn't have thought it was funny. That just reading the jokes, I might have thought, well, this is really adolescent. But seeing it on the screen, it was one really good laugh after another. Ben, when you read the script, did you realize how funny the actual movie could be?
I think I did. I just knew what the Farrellys did, and I knew. I guess I know enough about the process of making a comedy that, you know, what's on the page and the final product, there's so much that goes on in between that I knew it could be something that was really different. A couple of the scenes, like the scene, you know, like the quote-unquote hair gel scene that everybody loves to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
When I read that, I thought it really made me laugh. And I thought if somebody's going to do this in a movie and I have an opportunity to be a part of that, I would like to go out there and try to, you know, go out on a limb with that. And it really, it was something I hadn't seen before, so I thought it would be a good gamble. I thought either it would work really well or it would just be a ridiculous movie that people would, you know, just, it would just be like a huge disaster.
Is there a line people quote back at you from the film when they see you?
Yes. There's, you know, people like to yell out Frank and Beans for some reason. I don't know why. And, of course, the ever-present, you've got something on your ear.
Right.
People seem to think is the first time I've ever heard that.
I'm sure. What impact did it have on you to be in such a big hit?
It's basically just makes you very, very identifiable with the film. And people, you know, recognize me a lot more. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. They just kind of, you know, they love the movie. And so I get a lot of, that was the funniest movie ever. I love that movie. I love the scene. You got your thing caught in your set. You know, there's just a lot of positive feedback that is kind of, I don't want to say it's constant, but it's a lot of the time. And it's all related to the fact, I think, that they enjoyed the movie so much.
No, I can attest to the fact it's
honestly,
almost constant for Ben. He cannot walk down the street without, like,
I think
from the age of 6 to 23 have to shout at him every 5 feet that he's walking.
But the thing is, I think people feel very, like, you know, the character is a very approachable character because... You know,
right.
The character in the movie is a nice guy. So I think that that kind of runs over. So people just feel like it's okay. And that's totally fine. And, you know, it's nice. It's a nice thing. It's sometimes it's you don't want to deal with it. But for the most part, it's a very positive thing.
My guests are Ben Stiller and Janine Garofalo. And they've co-authored a parody of a self-help book called Feel This Book, An Essential Guide to Self-Empowerment, Spiritual Supremacy, and Sexual Satisfaction. Janine Garofalo, I want to ask you about your role in Clay Pigeons, which I thought was a very funny, ironic turn on the film noir. And you play a cop in it.
Yeah, I was an FBI agent.
Yeah. And
in that.
It was a very good role for you. Tell me a little bit about how you got the role and what you liked about it.
Well, I had read the script originally and actually was not pleased with some of what I perceived to be rather misogynistic qualities to the script. And the part originally, I think, was written for a man, the FBI agent, and they were thinking of going male or female. And I was like, well, there has to be a female in this that's doing something other than wearing next to nothing and getting killed. So it is incumbent upon me I have a responsibility to be in this now and trying to lend some kind of voice of reason to some of the goings on in here. Plus, I wanted very much to work with Vince Vaughn and Joaquin Phoenix. So that's how I got involved with that project.
You must have done some rewriting of the part, because it's been a while since I saw the film, but there's one scene in which, as I recall, the Vince Vaughn character is trying to, who's the bad guy, is trying to pick mm-hmm. you up in a diner or something. And you just have these great comeback put-down lines for him.
Vince is an incredibly funny guy and a great actor, and they basically just let the camera roll, and we pretty much just had a conversation, and that's what was very much edited down and put into the film. But anytime that we're laughing and stuff like that, it's real, and the things that we said to each other were stuff that we basically just kind of made up to say, although one line was written where... I can't remember, something about the first guy not wearing denim or something was written, and then basically every other thing was... just a conversation we had that they filmed.
Do you have a favorite part from that?
I actually don't really remember. I think something like when he was reading my palm or something, just the sheer corniness of it.
Did you see the movie, Janine?
I didn't see it.
This brings to light a very interesting fact that Janine doesn't like to see her own movies.
I did see parts of Clay Pigeons. And I know I saw that scene because I very much enjoy watching Vince work. But for the most part, I try not to see my films, if at all possible.
Tell us more about that scene and the part you're going to say when he's reading the palm of your hand, and then we'll find out why you don't see your movies.
You know, as I recall, I just think when he did it, it just took me by surprise, and it was so corny that it made me laugh really, really hard when people try that kind of thing with you. Like, it's just an excuse to touch your hand, and then they get kind of fake spiritual with you. Those types of things, I think that just made me laugh really hard, and... that part of shooting I enjoyed with Vince very much.
Well, I think the thing to do here is to play a clip of that scene from Clay Pigeons.
Are you into the stars at all? No.
Astrology?
No.
What about those stones things? You pull them stones
the
out?
The runestones?
Yeah.
No.
Can I see your hand for a second, please?
Why?
Well, I don't mean to give you cause for alarm or anything, but I think your aura's a little bit cluttered. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, man. Let's see here. Well, it's just as I expected. It says here that you like country western music. Small town. What do I know? That you like a whole lot of things you never gave yourself a chance to like.
Oh. Mm.
Would you try my hat on for me, please?
Do you think it'll help?
I don't know, but it'll be a lot of fun at the bar.
That's Janine Garofalo and Vince Vaughn in Clay Pigeons. Now, Janine Garofalo, now you have to explain to us why you don't see your own movies.
Well, I've seen parts of some. First of all, I try not to see them before any press tours or press junkets or promotions for things, because if I don't like it, I don't want to lie to people.
That's a very interesting reason.
Yeah, I don't feel like I want to compromise my integrity in that way and then expect people to believe me on another press tour for another book or movie or TV show. I don't feel it's fair to ask for $8.50 from someone if I don't even believe in it.
But let me stop you there, because that implies that you're concerned whenever you're making a movie that there's a chance you're not going to like it.
Yes, so I don't see it before the press tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say that during the press tour. I'll say I haven't seen it yet. You know, I know, and I'll be very honest. I'll say, you know, when I was shooting this, I like this very much. I think it's going to be very good. Or I'll say, I have no idea how this is going to turn out. Or I'll say, the script was fantastic. It's anybody's guess what would happen. But but also, it's not pleasant to see yourself blown up on a screen, 20 feet tall and sitting there, you know, every imperfection, every insecurity that you have. And then you have to hear your voice. And maybe, you know, if you didn't like your performance, it's very painful to watch yourself in a film.
I think Robert Klein said in his act once, like, when you look at yourself on screen, it's like a nose hair becomes a pine tree.
Yeah, yes. And your pores are big moon craters. But, and that's true. And, you know, all of those kinds of things cause one great pain. And so there's that. But also, no, the main thing is I don't like to do press and not be as, I would prefer to be diplomatic mm-hmm. about things that I'm promoting. I do think this book is funny. I've read the book. You know, I wrote part of it, and Ben wrote the other part of it, and I do like this book. So I can honestly tell you I've read it and I enjoy it. But some movies that I've done, I can't honestly say, that's a great film. Give me $8.50. You know, that's mm-hmm. a lot of money.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Janine Garofalo and Ben Stiller co-wrote the new self-help parody, Feel This Book. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Serta, maker of the Serta Perfect Sleeper Mattress, helping generations of Americans to sleep since 1931. And from Bantam Books, publisher of 101 Ways by Mako Yoshikawa, a debut novel about three generations of women and their lost loves. Available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Roger Genver Smith performs an excerpt from his one-man show about Huey P. Newton, the co-founder of the Black Panther Party. Smith also stars in the forthcoming Spike Lee film about the Son of Sam. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new release by the rock trio Sleater-Kinney. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Roger Genver Smith's one-man show, A Huey P. Newton Story, has won 2 Obie Awards, the Helen Hayes Award, and 3 NAACP Awards. The show is about the co-founder of the Black Panther Party. Smith first became aware of Newton from the iconic poster in which Newton was seated in a chair with a spear in one hand and a rifle in the other. Smith presents a portrait of a complex man who went from preaching revolutionary politics to being shot to death in a drug deal. After performing the show in New York, Smith took it on the road. The Freedom Theater in Philadelphia is presenting his performance through May 23rd. Smith has appeared in several Spike Lee films, including School Days, Do the Right Thing, Get on the Bus, and He Got Game. He stars as the detective in Lee's forthcoming film about the serial killer Son of Sam. Smith also co-starred in the film Eve's Bayou. Let's start with an excerpt of A Huey P. Newton Story.
Testing 1, 2. Testing 1, 2, is this thing on? Okay. I'm terrified of a microphone stuck up in my face, disembodied voices coming into my headphones. To tell you the truth, I'm actually a rather shy individual. I wouldn't consider myself to be very charismatic. I never really did anything hero-like, you know. I just worked on some little community programs. I do have a role to play. However, I'm a theorist of sorts. I work on theories, but I really do not enjoy discussing the details of my personal life, except as it relates to the movement. To tell you the truth, I hate interviews. I hate tape recorders, microphones stuck up. Even face, tell you the truth, I hate stages because they put you up on stage and they expect for you to entertain them. And I keep trying to tell people I'm not an entertainer. But I'll tell a funny story and then I think I'd like to get out of here because this is really like solitary confinement sitting up in this radio studio. The day I came out of prison was a hot, sunny day. Sun was shining, so I took my shirt off. And a lot of people wanted to read like a grand gesture into that, like it was something significant, but really, it was just a little simple act. I'd been in solitary confinement for 3 years. I came out, the sun was shining, so I took my shirt off. And then shortly thereafter, I received through the mail like a brochure from some Hollywood outfit, and they had some, you know, some little clippings in there, you know, with my picture on, with my shirt off, and they had a little letter attached to the clippings, and the letter from the Hollywood studio says something to the effect of, "Dear Mr. Newton, we feel that you are star quality." Something like that. You have star quality, something like that. It's funny, isn't it? Anyway, these Hollywood studios are a trip because they're in the business of creating fiction, but we in the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense are in the business of creating nonfiction. We're making revolution coming soon to a cinema near you.
That was Roger Genver Smith performing an excerpt of his show, A Huey P. Newton Story. And Roger, thank you for performing that. It seems to me there's a lot of contradictions in Huey Newton's personality that you bring out in your performance. For example, in parts of the monologue, he sounds, you know, really kind of intelligent and interesting and like someone who has a sense of humor about himself and the world. And in other parts, he sounds really addled and very pretentious and confused. I don't know if you see it this way.
Well, no, I don't see it that way because I'm not in the audience. I'm playing the character.
Okay.
And I have to commit to the brilliance and I have to commit to the confusion.
Uh-huh.
And I don't step outside of Huey and look at him. I try to be him, play him in the moment. Now, as a playwright, as someone who has put this material together, yes, of course, I recognize the contradictions which are inherent in Huey's personality, and I think that this is what makes for effective drama. Huey, in a sense, has been my Hamlet. He is a man who, with Bobby Seale, organized a highly disciplined, internationally influential political group
as a very young man. But as an older man, he became addicted to various forms of cocaine and lost his life, in fact, in front of a crack cocaine house on the Oakland streets, the same Oakland streets where he and Bobby Seale had co-founded the party in 1966.
You portray Huey Newton, and as we heard, with a kind of high-pitched, very tentative-sounding voice. There's a lot of nervous tics in his body when you portray him. Your legs are always just kind of jittering back and forth. Where did you listen to recordings of his voice and see him? Where do those physical embodiments come from?
Well, they come from a study of Huey through videotape and listening to Huey through audio tape as well. But people know Huey as that one-dimensional poster, and they are rather startled to hear this voice coming out of him, Louisiana drawl, high-pitched, tentative, as you say. He was not really comfortable as a public speaker. He was more comfortable as someone who was engaged in serious poetic, philosophical dialogue. He was not the great public presence, as were many of his peers, Bobby Seale, of course, Eldridge Cleaver, Kathleen Cleaver, Angela Davis, Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, H. Rapp Brown, Stokely Carmichael. All of these people were dynamic public personalities, and Huey was not. In fact, when he came out of prison in 1970 and went on a college speaking tour, he said that it was one of the worst experiences of his life. Many people booed him. Many people walked out on him because he was not the political poster come to life.
He was someone who talked like this.
Right. You grew up in the Los Angeles area. Huey Newton was from Oakland, and it was in Oakland that he co-founded the Panthers. And I'm wondering what image you had of him when you were growing up, and what he kind of represented to you politically, and if you felt when you were young that you needed some revolution in your life.
My parents came to California for the same reasons that Huey Newton's parents came to California, to seek the opportunity that they were denied in a racist, segregated South. So in terms of revolution, which means change, as Huey continues to remind us, we were both engaged in the same revolution because we were first-generation Californians whose parents had raised us in California so that we might have opportunities that were denied them. In terms of Huey's parents in Louisiana and in Arkansas, in terms of my parents in Virginia and South Carolina. Huey as an image for me, as I said, was primarily one-dimensional, someone who was in a poster, someone whose picture was printed on the Black Panther paper. And as the years went on, I heard less and less of Huey. He, of course, was in exile in Cuba for 3 years during the 1970s, lived a rather low-key life throughout the 1980s, earned a PhD at the University of California at Santa Cruz. And I heard a variety of news blurbs throughout the 1980s, Huey receives PhD, Huey arrested in bar brawl, Huey indicted for embezzling funds from the Panther School. So it was that kind of strange jigsaw puzzle that I wanted to put together in doing this piece.
Now, I know when you were young, I guess this was probably a pretty formative experience for you. You traveled with the actor William Marshall and the Society for Black Heritage Drama. And William Marshall, in addition to, you know, his many theater roles, was also Blackula and the King of Cartoons for a while on Pee-wee's Playhouse. What kind of works did you perform?
Well, we did Aimé Césaire's great piece on King Christophe of Haiti, dealing with the Haitian Revolution. We would also perform an assortment of poems. We toured with the late, great Horace Tapscott's Pan-African People's Orchestra. We went typically to churches, to schools, to community centers. It was there that I first really was engaged in theater as a form of cultural expression, as an antidote, as it were, to those roles which we did not feel were enlightening, which were in fact demeaning, engaged in great literature, in great poetry. And I was very fortunate to have worked with Mr. Marshall, who's a wonderful artist who I'm sure could have done much, much more with his career had he been willing to make a fool of himself.
It must have been pretty exciting as a teenager to tour with a group that was both rooted in classic theater and in the avant-garde at the same time.
Well, I've been doing that throughout, and as I said, that was really the beginning of that mm-hmm. way of working.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked traditional theater at the Guthrie. I've worked with avant-garde troupes such as Mabu Mines here in New York City. So I've always dug into a great variety of work, from Spike Lee films to my independent stage to All My Children, in which I played Miles Christopher for a season or so.
What was Miles Christopher like?
Miles Christopher was a very mysterious character, and he was involved with a character by the name of Belinda Kiefer, and they had a very hot relationship.
Right. My guest is Roger Genver Smith. He's currently performing his one-man show, A Huey P. Newton Story, in Philadelphia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Roger Genver Smith. He's won several awards for his one-man show, A Huey P. Newton Story, and he's appeared in several Spike Lee films. We've talked a little bit about your Huey P. Newton show, which you've been performing for a couple of years. You have a new movie coming out, I think this summer, directed by Spike Lee, and it's his movie about the Son of Sam murders, and I believe you play the detective who's tracking down the Son of Sam, and the movie's called Summer of Sam. Tell us a little bit about your role in this forthcoming film.
Well, I play a detective named Kurt Atwater, who is tracking down the Son of Sam, a man who has been terrorizing the streets of New York City for more than a year in the summer of 1977.
I guess for any of our listeners who don't know him, he was a serial killer who thought that, God was telling him to go out and kill people. God or his dog, actually. I forget which it was.
Actually, it was, he claimed that his neighbor's dog, told him to kill any number of people, which he did quite tragically.
You've been working with Spike Lee for years. I mean, dating back to Do the Right Thing, in which you played Smiley, the guy who stutters. How did you first start working with Spike Lee?
Well, I started working with Spike Lee more than 10 years ago. We did a film called School Days. I auditioned for him for that, and I played a fraternity pledge at a fictitious Southern college. I went on to do the Right Thing with Spike. I played a character by the name of Smiley. Smiley was not scripted in Spike's screenplay, but he encouraged me to make a contribution to the piece, and that I did, playing a young man who was walking up and down the street in Bedford-Stuyvesant,
attempting to sell personally colorized photographs of Malcolm X shaking hands with Martin Luther King. Smiley eventually burned the pizza parlor down on the block and put the picture of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X on the burned pizza parlor wall. He became kind of a moral spine for the piece.
Gee, how'd you go from a part that wasn't scripted to the character who actually burns down the pizza parlor, which is like the pivotal part of the climax?
Well, that's the beauty of improvisation. And that's the kind of working relationship that Spike and I have continued to have to this day.
Does this mean that Spike Lee didn't know the pizza parlor was going to burn down when the film started shooting?
No, the pizza parlor was going to be burned down in the original screenplay, but we didn't know who was going to light the match, and it turned out that Smiley was the person who lit the match.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Roger Genver Smith, and the one-man show that he does is called A Huey P. Newton Story. Now, I believe that your parents owned a motel for a while. Do I have that right?
That's right.
What's the story behind the motel? How they decided to open it?
Well, my parents came initially to Los Angeles in the early 1950s, and they wanted to rent a motel room, and they were denied the opportunity to rent the room because they were seen as a quote-unquote mixed couple, my father being darker than I, my mother being more fair than I. They assumed that my mother was a white woman and my father was obviously a black man, and they were denied accommodation. They did not know that my mother was a black woman, and they did not know that my father was a lawyer and would sue them, because that is how he had been making his living in the early 1950s, by suing places that would not accommodate black and Latino people in California. So they sued successfully, took the money, and built their own motel.
Where did they build it?
In Los Angeles.
And did you...
About 3 blocks away from the original motel that denied them accommodation. They actually took business away from them.
So did your parents become professional motel keepers after that, or did they hire other people to do it and your father continued with his law practice?
My father's law office was included within the building, which included the motel. My mother practiced dentistry in the same building.
Huh. This must have taught you an incredible lesson about, you know, being turned down. I mean, it's just an incredible story of how they took this insult and created something out of it, created something really constructive as a result of it.
Yeah, and it taught me how to work a switchboard and to sweep cigarette butts off of a
How about room service?
Do room service and change sheets and all that.
Did you live in the motel a lot, or just work there?
Actually, I did live there for a while because I was doing the night shift as a teenager.
What was that like?
An education.
I always think it's so interesting for people who grow up in part in a hotel or a motel.
It was quite educational. Let me just put it that way. And there were some great people who stayed there. Mungo Santa Maria stayed there. Dr. Martin Luther King passed through. Some wonderful people, some crazy people came through as well. Maybe that'll be my next play.
Roger Genver Smith is performing his show, A Huey P. Newton Story, in Philadelphia through May 23rd. Coming up, Sleater Kinney's new CD. This is Fresh Air. The new collection of songs from the rock trio Sleater Kinney is called The Hot Rock. The title may be a reference to the 1972 Robert Redford theft movie, with lyrics to prove they've seen it. But rock critic Ken Tucker says the collection is more about another kind of hot rock, the molten lava of emotions in a tumultuous love affair.
Three women of Sleater Kinney, singer Corin Tucker, guitarist Carrie Brownstein, drummer Janet Weiss, continue to make some of the most intense music in rock and roll. Most often, Tucker's laser-like vocals cut across Brownstein's jagged guitar lines, while Weiss's drums race around them, thrashing out a desperate beat. On their previous CDs, they've often sustained a terrific, exhilarating intensity. The most immediately noticeable distinction on The Hot Rock, therefore, is the way the band is trying out different speeds, sometimes slowing things down to walk more slowly around a melody, opening up trap doors of sadness and grief.
Love is the size of these tumors inside us. Love is the size of hospital room, in my hospital groan, the ring on my fingers, so tight it turns blue, constant reminder, dying.
The other refinement in Sleater Kinney's new music is that, increasingly, Tucker is sharing vocals with Brownstein, but in a typically atypical way. On a song such as the one I'm about to play, called Burn Don't Freeze, Tucker sings the main melody, while Brownstein speaks lines beneath her, posing contrapuntal sounds as well as emotions.
Darkest
There's a moroseness running through this CD like a deep cut. That song seems to talk about the frustration of still being in love with someone who's no longer in love with you. Brownstein's spoken vocal acts as the conscience of Tucker's narrator, murmuring about rejection by saying, "Baby's putting me out," that is to say, putting out the fire of the romance that still burns in the singer. It's a theme that runs more subtly through the rest of the CD as well. There's no way that music as assiduously discordant as Sleater-Kinney's is ever going to appeal to a wide audience, and one of the many admirable things about the band is that they don't expect or even want it to. In a recent interview, Brownstein said that if the group started selling CDs in the millions, it would, quote, "be really strange. I don't know if I could sleep at night," she said. "We've definitely grown," she noted, "but the larger you get, the bigger the disconnect with your audience gets, and that starts to get scary." Well, if there's one thing the hot rock proves, it's that this band is not timorous about facing down its own fears.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Sleater-Kinney's new CD, The Hot Rock. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Roberta Shurrock, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Sam Adams. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Art Legacy Gallery, offering a variety of fine art, handcrafted items, jewelry, and custom furniture. On the web at artlegacy.com. And from Bayback Books, publisher of Philistines at the Hedgerow, Passion and Property in the Hamptons by Stephen Gaines. Available in paperback and as a Time Warner audiobook. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Cameron Manheim on her Emmy Award-winning role in The Practice and why she no longer considers the word fat a bad word. In fact, her new memoir is called Wake Up, I'm Fat. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.